So before we jump in today, a quick shout out to our sponsor. This deep dive is brought to you by CERT Fuel. They've got, a full series 65 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and like unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. It's an incredible tool for test prep, so check them out at certfuel.com.
It really is. I mean, having practice exams that actually mirror the real test is huge.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so let's unpack this. Imagine getting hit with, I don't know, a 25% just totally wealth-destroying tax penalty just because you didn't know the 24-month rule on a brand new retirement account.
Which happens, by the way. People do it all the time.
Right. You thought you were doing the responsible thing by saving, and suddenly the IRS is just taking a massive bite out of your money. If you were prepping for the Series 65, you were going to see scenarios exactly like that one.
Oh, absolutely. They love testing those traps.
And let's be honest, you're sitting there, maybe you've got ADHD like me, and reading traditional textbooks about the Internal Revenue Code is basically a prescription for an impromptu nap.
It's incredibly dry.
It is. The bullet points blur together, the phase-out limits look like random phone numbers. But our mission today is to take those dry rules, flip them upside down, and make them stick in your brain so you can completely dominate this exam.
Because that's really the only way to learn this material. We have to, move away from staring at tables of numbers and sterile IRS definitions.
Yeah, those don't work for me at all.
Right.
Yeah.
We need to see how these rules apply to actual human behavior, the actual panic, and, actual greed, because that is what the exam is really testing.
They don't just ask you for a definition.
Exactly. They aren't going to just ask you, what is the limit? They are going to give you a messy, real-world scenario and ask, can this person do this without completely blowing up their financial life?
Which is why, to make this memorable, we are going to use three fictional but highly recognizable characters to test all of these rules today.
I love these characters.
Use it right. I want you, the listener, to vividly picture these people in your head right now. They're going to be our personal crash test dummies for the IRS tax code. We are going to put them in terrible financial situations and see if they survive.
Let's do it. Who is first?
First up, we have Frank the founder. Frank is a chaotic small business owner. He runs a tech startup out of a heavily mortgaged garage.
We all know a Frank.
Oh, definitely. He runs on caffeine and panic. He absolutely hates paying taxes. He loves bending the rules right up to the breaking point. And, he occasionally flirts with total bankruptcy. He's the guy who always thinks he's one step ahead of the government.
He perfectly represents the self-employed, highly variable income demographic. The exam loves testing that guy.
Yeah, they do. Okay, next we have teacher Tina. Tina is a fiercely dedicated public school teacher. She's been teaching fourth grade math in the same school district for 25 years.
The backbone of the system right there.
Totally. She works incredibly long hours. She is intensely loyal to her district. She plans to work until she drops. And she absolutely loves a good, steady, predictable catch-up contribution.
Tina represents the public sector, nonprofit, steady earner demographic. Very different rules for her.
Very different. And finally, we have Dr. Dave. Dave is a highly compensated chief of surgery at a massive healthcare conglomerate. His income is astronomical. We're talking $500,000-$600,000 a year.
Which sounds amazing.
Right. It sounds amazing, except Dave is incredibly frustrated because his income is always too high for all the normal tax breaks. He's constantly hitting an income ceiling, getting locked out of deductions, and he is always demanding his accountants find a way around the rules.
So we have the chaotic entrepreneur, the loyal public servant, and the high-income corporate executive. It's a perfect trio.
They cover all the bases.
They do. And the reason we are using these three to understand retirement plans is simple. This topic is massively important for your Series 65 exam.
It's what, 6% of the test?
Roughly 6% of your entire test, yeah. That is about 8 questions standing directly between you and a passing score. But if we zoom out and connect this to the bigger picture, retirement accounts are really the lifeblood of wealth management.
It's the foundation of everything financial advisors do.
Exactly. We aren't just memorizing arbitrary contribution limits today. We are learning the actual architecture of American tax avoidance.
The architecture of American tax avoidance. I love that phrasing. It makes it sound like we're planning a casino heist.
Well, in a legal way, maybe?
Right, a total legal heist. And every good heist requires a rock-solid understanding of the building's foundation. So before we get to the massive, complex employer plans that companies offer, we have to start with the bedrock of individual wealth in this country, the individual retirement account, the IRA.
That is exactly where we need to start. Let's look at the absolute foundation, the traditional IRA and the Roth IRA.
Okay, lay out the baseline numbers for us.
Let's establish the 2026 rules. The absolute maximum you can put into an IRA, and this is a combined limit across all of your IRAs, is $7,500.
Across all of them. So you can't put that much in a traditional A&E, that much in a Roth.
Exactly. It's a combined total bucket of $7,500. Now, if you are 50 years old or older, the IRS acknowledges that retirement is looming, so they throw you a bone.
The catch-up contribution.
Right. You get an $1,100 catch-up contribution. That brings your total maximum to $8,600 for the year.
Okay, let me stop you right there, because here is where it gets really interesting and where test takers immediately trip up. I want to clarify something crucial about where that money actually comes from.
The earned income rule.
Yes. You must have what the IRS explicitly calls earned income to play this game. You cannot fund an IRA with lottery winnings.
No, you definitely cannot.
Like, if Frank the founder goes to Vegas, puts his last $1,000 on black, and wins 50 grand, he cannot put a single dime of those winnings into an IRA.
That is a fundamental rule. It cannot be passive income. You cannot fund an IRA with rental income from an apartment building you own either.
Or like stock dividends.
Nope. No stock dividends, no capital gains, no inheritance from your grandmother. It has to be money you earn from actively working. That means W-2 wages from an employer or net earnings from self-employment.
So it's a reward for actual labor.
Hmm.
But wait. Let's think about how people actually live. What happens if one spouse works full-time and the other spouse stays home?
This is a great testable scenario.
Right, let's bring in Frank the founder. Let's say Frank's chaotic startup actually lands a huge contract. He has a massive year. He's pulling in plenty of earned income from his business. But his spouse doesn't have a W-2. She manages their household full-time and doesn't draw a salary anywhere.
Okay, I see where you're going.
If the rule is strictly you must have earned income, does Frank's wife just miss out on having an IRA completely? Because her personal earned income is technically zero.
You would think so based on a strict reading of the rule, but the IRS actually created a very specific carve-out for this exact scenario. It is called the spousal IRA.
The spousal IRA. How does that work?
As long as Frank and his wife file a joint tax return, and Frank's earned income is high enough to cover the contributions for both of them, his non-working spouse can absolutely open and fund her own IRA.
Oh, that makes total sense. They are looking at the household as a single economic unit.
They are. The IRS essentially looks at their joint return and says, well, there's enough active earned income generated by this household to support two separate IRAs.
So Frank can put $7,500 into his account, and his wife can put $7,500 into her own entirely separate account.
Exactly. All based purely on Frank's labor.
Okay. So the spousal IRA is the legal workaround for the earned income rule, provided you are married, filing jointly. Listeners, file that away. That's a classic exam question.
Definitely a high probability topic.
So we've got the money. We've proven we earned it. Now, where do we put it? We have a direct comparison to make that is really the core of modern financial planning, traditional versus Roth. This is the classic showdown.
It is the most frequent decision an investor makes, and the difference all comes down to a single question. When do you want to pay the tax man?
Now or later.
Exactly. Let's analyze the traditional IRA first. With a traditional IRA, you are generally putting in pre-tax money, meaning you might get to deduct that $7,500 contribution from your taxable income this year.
So it actively shrinks your tax bill today.
Right. If you make $100,000 and you deduct $7,500, the IRS taxes you as if you only made $92,500.
You get a discount on your taxes right now. Instant gratification.
And then the money grows tax deferred. You do not pay taxes on the dividends, the interest, or the capital gains year after year while it sits inside the account.
It just snowballs.
It compounds without the drag of annual taxation. But there is a catch. When you finally retire and take the money out, every single dollar you withdraw is taxed as ordinary income at whatever your tax rate is in retirement.
You are basically kicking the tax can down the road. You are looking at the IRS and saying, I will gladly pay you on a Tuesday for a hamburger today.
That is the traditional model in a nutshell. Now, contrast that entirely with the Roth IRA. The Roth operates on the exact opposite logic.
The complete reverse.
Yes. You get absolutely zero tax deduction up front. You are putting in after-tax dollars, money that the IRS has already taken their slice of.
So no instant gratification.
None. But because you paid your toll at the entrance, the money grows completely tax-free. And when you take it out in retirement, assuming you meet the rules, every single dollar is entirely tax-free. You owe the IRS nothing on the growth.
The ultimate delayed gratification. You pay the pain today for a tax-free wonderland tomorrow.
But wait, you mentioned assuming you meet the rules for the Roth.
I did. What makes a Roth withdrawal officially qualified and tax-free?
Yeah.
Because the exam loves the word qualified.
There are two hurdles you must clear for it to be completely tax-free. First, the Roth account must have been open and funded for at least 5 full tax years.
The 5-year clock. Got it.
Second, you must be either 59 and a half years old, or you die and pass it to an heir, or you become permanently disabled, or, and this is a very specific exception, you use it for a first-time home purchase.
Oh, a first-time home purchase, like any amount.
No, up to a $10,000 lifetime limit. But if you hit the 5-year mark and one of those criteria, the entire withdrawal of all your explosive growth is completely tax-free.
Okay, so that is the structural difference, pre-tax versus after-tax.
Yeah.
But now we have to talk about who is actually allowed to use these tools, because this is where the exam lays a massive, jagged trap for the unwary test taker.
Ah, yes, the phase-outs.
We have to talk about phase-outs. Listener, if your brain is wandering, lock back in right now.
Yeah.
I want you to pause. Whatever you are doing, I'm going to ask you a direct question, and I want you to mentally lock in an answer before we explain it.
Let's see how they do.
Let's bring in Dr. Dave. Dave is a highly compensated executive. He's single. He makes $300,000 a year in W-2 wages. Here is the exam question. Can Dr. Dave put $7,500 into a traditional IRA this year?
Think about his huge salary.
Right. Think about it. Can he contribute to a traditional IRA? Got your answer.
The answer is yes. He absolutely can.
I know for a fact half of the people listening just screamed no at their steering wheel because they know rich people get phased out of things.
It is arguably the most common point of confusion on this topic. Here is the golden rule. You must memorize anyone with earned income, no matter how ridiculously high that income is, can contribute to a traditional IRA.
Anyone.
The income phase-outs for a traditional IRA, for instance, if you're a single filer and you are covered by a retirement plan at work, your ability to deduct the contribution phases out entirely by $91,000.
Okay, wait. So if he makes over $91K, what happens?
That limit does not stop you from putting the money into the account. It only limits your ability to take the tax deduction.
This is such a brilliant, evil distinction by the test writers. So Dave can put his money in. But because he makes 300 grand and he has a 401k at his hospital, the IRS says, Dave, you can put the money in the traditional IRA, but you get absolutely zero tax deduction for it today.
Exactly. It is a non-deductible contribution. He gets the tax deferred growth, but no upfront deduction.
Okay, but now let's look at the Roth IRA for Dr. Dave. Yeah. Listener, same scenario. Can Dave, making $300,000, contribute directly to a Roth IRA?
Not a chance in hell, right?
Right. There's no way.
For a Roth IRA, the phase-outs do not apply to deductions because there are no deductions anyway. The phase-outs apply to contributions.
So they actually block you.
They completely block you. If you are a single filer in 2026, the Roth phase-out ends entirely at $168,000. If your modified adjusted gross income is a single dollar over that limit, you are legally barred from contributing to a Roth IRA directly.
Okay, here is how I want you to visualize this for the exam, because you need an image to anchor this concept. The Roth IRA is a literal VIP club in a trendy downtown district.
I like this.
And there is a massive, intimidating bouncer standing at a velvet rope, and his only job is to check your W-2. Dr. Dave walks up, nice. Flashes his $300,000 W-2, and the bouncer laughs. Sorry, man, you make too much money. You can't come in.
The Roth VIP club bars high earners entirely. You cannot get through the front door.
Exactly. Now, across the street from the VIP club is the traditional IRA pub. It's a total dive bar. The floors are sticky, the neon sign is flickering, everyone is welcome.
No bouncer at the door?
The bouncer at the dive bar doesn't care how much you make, as long as you have a job. Dr. Dave walks over, shows his W-2, and the bouncer says, come on in, Dave. Anyone can get in the door of the traditional IRA. But hey, when Dave walks up to the bartender to get a drink, the bartender looks at him and says, hey, I see you make 300 grand and you have a 401k over at the hospital. You can hang out in the bar, but I'm taking away your free drink tickets.
The free drink tickets are the tax deduction.
Right. The bartender takes his deduction.
That analogy perfectly encapsulates the mechanics. Traditional IRAs have deduction phase-outs. Roth IRAs have contribution phase-outs.
You can remember the bouncer at the VIP club versus the bartender at the dive bar. You will get those questions right.
It's a great visual. But wait, let's look at this from Dr. Dave's perspective. He is a rich corporate executive. Rich guys always find a loophole.
Oh, always.
Yeah.
They pay accountants a lot of money to find loopholes.
Exactly. Dave looks across the street at that Roth VIP club. He wants that tax-free growth. He demands tax-free growth. Are you telling me he's just permanently locked out of the VIP club forever?
He is not. And this is a perfect moment to introduce one of the most widely used loopholes in financial planning.
The backdoor Roth.
Yes, the Roth conversion, universally known in the industry as the backdoor Roth strategy. The underlying logic here is fascinating.
It really is. The IRS placed very strict income limits on who can contribute to a Roth IRA directly. But for reasons that still baffle some tax policy experts, they completely removed the INFRA limits on who can convert an existing traditional IRA into a Roth IRA.
Wait. Let me get this straight in the context of our analogy. The front door to the VIP club is heavily guarded by the bouncer, but there's a back door in the alleyway that is just propped open, and anyone can just walk through it.
Essentially, yes. Any taxpayer, regardless of whether they make $50,000 or $50 million, can take money currently sitting in a traditional IRA and declare to the IRS, I am converting this to a Roth IRA.
That's wild. But it's not totally free, right?
No, the IRS isn't stupid. When you convert pre-tax money to a Roth, you have to pay ordinary income tax on the converted amount in the year you perform the conversion.
Right, because the IRS wants their cut before it enters the tax-free zone forever.
Exactly. But look at how Dr. Dave uses this. Dave makes a $7,500 contribution to the traditional IRA.
He goes to the dive bar.
Right. Remember, he's allowed in the dive bar. But because of his high income, it is a non-deductible contribution. He got no tax break for it. The very next week, he walks out the back door of the dive bar, crosses the alley, and converts that $7,500 into the Roth VIP club.
Oh, I see it.
Because he never got a tax deduction on that money in the first place, it's mostly after-tax money already. He owes virtually zero tax on the conversion itself.
And just like that, Dave has money sitting in a Roth IRA, growing tax-free for the rest of his life, despite making way over the income limit.
Just like that.
That feels so illegal, but it is explicitly allowed. So for the exam, listener, lock this in. Income limits apply strictly to Roth contributions. There are zero income limits on Roth conversions. That is a massive nugget of testable knowledge.
It absolutely is. And understanding how money moves into these accounts perfectly transitions us to the next logical phase. We've talked extensively about getting the money in, but the IRS doesn't just let you park money in a tax shelter without attaching massive strings to it.
No, they do not.
We need to talk about what happens when you try to get the money out.
The Great Escape. We need to cover withdrawals, required minimum distributions, and the terrifying rollover hostage situation. Let's start with taking it out too early.
Because life happens, people panic, they need cash.
Right. But if you touch your retirement money before you hit the magic age of 59 and a half, the IRS smacks you with the dreaded 10% early withdrawal penalty.
And we need to carefully distinguish between the two types of IRAs here because the penalty applies differently. Let's look at the traditional IRA first. If you pull money out of a traditional IRA before age 59 and a half, you are penalized on the entire withdrawal. You have to pay ordinary income tax on the whole amount, POS, a 10% penalty on everything you withdrew. It is a devastating hit to your capital.
It's awful. You pull out 10 grand and you might only see 6 grand after taxes and penalties.
But for a Roth IRA, the rule is significantly more nuanced. The 10% early withdrawal penalty only applies to the earnings you withdraw early.
Wait, only the earnings. Why?
This is because of the IRS ordering rules for a Roth. The IRS assumes that the first money you pull out of a Roth is your original contributions, the money you already paid tax on.
Oh, wait.
And because they are your after-tax contributions, you can withdraw them at any time, at any age, completely tax-free and penalty-free.
Okay, let me make sure I have this exactly right. If I put in $20,000 over a few years and the account grows to $30,000, I'm 40 years old. I can pull out my original $20,000 with absolutely zero penalty.
That is correct. You can pull that 20 grand out whenever you want.
That's amazing.
It is. It is only when you exhaust your contributions and dip into that 10,000 of growth, the earnings, before age 59 and a half that you trigger both taxes and the 10% penalty on those earnings.
Okay, that makes the Roth much more flexible for a young person. But let's say someone does have to tap into a traditional IRA, or they dip into their Roth earnings early. There are exceptions to this 10% penalty, right? The IRS isn't a total monster.
They are not. There is a specific, highly testable list of exceptions to the 10% penalty. First, if the IRA owner dies, the beneficiary who inherits the account does not pay a 10% penalty when they withdraw the money, regardless of their age.
Okay, death. That makes sense.
Second, if you become totally and permanently disabled.
I assume the IRS is pretty strict about the definition of disabled.
Very strict. It generally means you are unable to engage in any substantial gainful activity due to a physical or mental impairment that is expected to result in death or be of long continued and indefinite duration. You can't just have a bad back and claim the exception.
Okay, so death and severe disability. What else?
You can set up something called SCPP, substantially equal periodic payments. This is a very specific actuarial calculation where you commit to taking steady, calculated withdrawals for at least 5 years or until you turn 59 and a half, whichever is longer. If you follow the strict formula, no penalty.
That sounds complicated, but good to know for the test. Keep going.
If the IRS places a levy on the account to collect back taxes, they don't charge you a penalty for taking the money to pay them.
Well, yeah, they're taking the money anyway.
Right. There is also a relatively new exception for qualified birth or adoption expenses, up to $5,000 per event.
That's nice.
You can avoid the penalty if you use the money to pay for unreimbursed medical expenses that exceed a certain percentage of your adjusted gross income. You can use it to pay health insurance premiums if you've been on unemployment compensation for at least 12 consecutive weeks.
Okay, so a safety net for major life problems.
Exactly. And finally, the two big ones that test takers always confuse you can use the money for a first-time home purchase, up to a strict $10,000 lifetime limit. And you can use it to pay for qualified higher education expenses like tuition and books for yourself, your spouse, or your kids.
Okay, listeners, stop right there. Red alert. Pay attention to those last two, the home purchase and the education exception.
This is a big one.
I have another direct question for you. Think about Frank, the founder. Frank has a ton of his money tied up in a 401k from an old corporate job he had before he started his chaotic company.
Huh.
He is completely cash poor right now because the startup is bleeding money.
Classic Frank.
His kid is starting college, and Frank also wants to buy a small starter home. He decides to pull $10,000 from his old 401k for the house and another $10,000 from his 401k to pay the tuition bill. He is 45 years old. Does Frank pay the 10% early withdrawal penalty on that $20,000?
Think about it.
You just heard the list. Does he pay the penalty?
This is one of the most vicious, intentionally misleading traps on the entire Series 65 exam. The answer is yes. Frank absolutely pays the 10% penalty on the entire amount.
Wait. I am putting myself in the shoes of the test taker. You literally just read the list of exceptions 2 minutes ago. First-time home buyer and higher education were explicitly on that list. Why is Frank penalized?
Because I read the list of exceptions for individual retirement accounts, IRAs.
Oh, man.
The first-time home buyer exception, capped at that $10,000 lifetime limit, and the higher education exception apply to IRAs only. They do not apply to employer-sponsored qualified plans like a 401k or a 403b.
So if he pulls it from a 401k...
If Frank pulls money directly from his 401k for a house or for college, he gets slammed with the 10% penalty.
That is so deeply arbitrary. It is the exact same money, just sitting in a slightly different tax vehicle.
It is arbitrary, but it is the law. Now consider the workaround. If Frank had rolled that 401k over into a traditional IRA first, waited for the transfer to clear, and then took the money out of the IRA to pay for college, zero penalty.
It is the perfect test question. Hey, Frank used the money for his kid's college tuition. That's an exception, right? Wrong. It was in a 401k, not an IRA. You're penalized. Memorize that, folks. Home and education exceptions are IRA exclusive. Do not fall for that on the exam.
So that thoroughly covers the dangers of taking the money out too early. But the IRS faces another problem. What happens if you try to leave the money in the tax shelter too late?
Right. You can't just hide it forever.
The IRS allowed you to defer taxes for decades, but they want their tax revenue eventually. They aren't going to wait forever. This introduces the concept of required minimum distributions, or RMDs.
The too late trap. The government finally calling in the loan.
Precisely. For traditional retirement accounts, you cannot defer taxes indefinitely. By law, you must begin taking RMDs by April 1st of the year following the year you turn 73.
73. Okay.
And just for context, if you were born in 1960 or later, that age gets pushed back to 75 starting in 2033. But for the purposes of the current exam cycle, focus on the age 73 rule.
Okay, let's say Frank the founder hits 73. He's stubborn. He hates taxes. He just doesn't do it. He refuses to pull the money out. What happens?
The penalty for failing to take an RMD is one of the harshest in the entire tax code.
Really? Worse than the early withdrawal?
Oh, much worse. It used to be a draconian 50% of the amount you were supposed to take. It has recently been reduced, but it is still incredibly severe, a 25% penalty on the amount not distributed.
25%.
Just
vanished.
And if you catch the mistake and correct it within a 2-year correction window, the penalty can be reduced to 10%. But either way, it is a massive, entirely unnecessary destruction of capital.
Okay, but as I look at this April 1st rule, I see a strategic puzzle, a potential loophole. Let me talk this out. The rule says I have to start taking the money by April 1st of the year following the year I turned 73. If I turn 73 this year, why wouldn't I just delay taking that very first RMD all the way to that April 1st deadline next year? That way, I keep my money growing tax deferred for an extra few months. It seems like the mathematically smart thing to do.
You have just stumbled into the double hit trap. And it is a classic scenario the exam loves to test because it preys on people trying to be too clever.
Uh-oh. What did I do?
Let's walk through the calendar. If you turn 73 in year one, your very first RMD is technically assigned to year one. You are granted the option to delay actually pulling that cash out until April 1st of year two.
Right. So I wait.
But here's the catch. You still have to take your normal year two RMD by December 31st of year two.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yes. If you delay your first RMD to April 1st of year two, you are forcing yourself to take TWO complete distributions in a single calendar tax year. You know, take year one's RMD in April and year two's RMD in December.
So, listener, ask yourself the obvious question. Why is this a terrible, horrible idea for someone like Dr. Dave or Frank?
Because taking two massive distributions in a single calendar year is going to cause a massive artificial spike in your taxable income for that specific year.
You're doubling your income.
Exactly. Depending on the size of your portfolio, that double withdrawal could easily push you into a brutal, much higher marginal tax bracket. You might have saved a few months of tax-deferred growth by waiting until April, but you lose horribly by paying a significantly higher percentage of taxes on the entire combined withdrawal.
You outsmarted yourself right into a higher tax bracket.
Yeah.
So the smart money, the standard advice, is to take that first RMD by December 31st of the year you turn 73, just to spread the tax hit out across two separate tax years. Got it.
Always spread it out.
Now, we just talked about traditional accounts. Is there an RMD gotcha for Roth IRAs? Do I have to pull my money out of the VIP club at 73?
There is a gotcha, but it's a wonderfully positive one. Roth IRAs have absolutely zero RMDs during the original owner's lifetime.
Yep.
None. You can leave the money in that account until the day you die, letting it compound tax-free for your heirs. This feature makes the Roth IRA an extraordinarily powerful estate planning tool.
The VIP club strikes again. No bouncers kicking you out at closing time. You can stay forever. Okay, let's talk about the logistics of moving money around. Rollovers. This is where innocent people accidentally blow up their retirement savings through sheer ignorance.
Moving money from a former employer's plan, like an old 401k, into an IRA. There are two ways to execute this transfer: the right way and the incredibly dangerous way.
Okay, let's start with the right way so people know what normal looks like.
The right way is called a direct rollover, which is also technically known as a trustee-to-trustee transfer. You contact the custodian of your 401k, say Fidelity, and you tell them to send the funds directly to the custodian of your new IRA, say Vanguard.
So Fidelity talks to Vanguard.
The money moves institution to institution. You, the account owner, never touch the money. It is clean, there are absolutely no tax consequences, and there is no mandatory tax withholding.
Beautiful, clean, and easy. But Frank, the founder, does not do things the easy way.
Never.
Frank decides to do an indirect rollover. He calls his old 401k provider and says, "Don't bother with Vanguard. Just cut a check payable directly to me, Frank. I will take it to the bank and deposit it into my IRA myself. I am a capable adult." I call this the rollover hostage situation. Walk us through the absolute horror show that Frank just initiated by asking for the check in his name.
The exact moment Frank asks for that check to be made payable to himself, he triggers a mandatory IRS rule. The employer must withhold 20% of the distribution for federal income taxes.
They just take it.
It is not optional. The employer has no choice. So let's look at the math. Let's say Frank's 401k had $100,000 in it. The employer takes out $20,000 and sends it directly to the IRS. Frank receives a check in the mail for only $80,000.
Okay, so Frank is holding an $80,000 check.
Yeah.
What is the ticking clock here?
Frank has exactly 60 days from the day he receives those funds to deposit the money into a new qualified account, like an IRA. If he does it within 60 days, it is considered a valid rollover, and he avoids taxes and penalties.
So Frank runs to his local bank on day 59, sweating, panicked. He deposits the $80,000 check into his IRA. The teller stamps it. He made the 60-day window. He's totally safe, right?
No. He is only partially safe. He successfully rolled over the $80,000 he had in his hand. But the IRS looks at the original account balance. What about the $20,000 the employer withheld and sent to the Treasury?
Right, the missing $20,000.
If Frank does not deposit the full original $100,000 into the IRA within those 60 days, the IRS treats that missing $20,000 as a permanent early withdrawal.
Wait, I want to make sure I'm grasping the absurdity of this. Are you telling me that Frank has to magically find $20,000 of his own external cash just to make up the difference?
Yes. To make the rollover whole in the eyes of the IRS, Frank has to deposit the $80,000 check he received. Plus, he has to drain his personal checking account or sell his car or dig into his couch cushions to find another $20,000 in cash and put all $100,000 into the IRA before day 60.
That is insane.
If he manages to do that, he avoids all penalties. And when he files his taxes the following year, he will report the clean rollover, and the IRS will refund him the $20,000 that the employer withheld.
Hence, the hostage situation. Mm-hmm. The IRS is literally holding $20,000 of Frank's money hostage until tax season next spring, and he has to front his own ransom money just to keep his retirement account intact.
Exactly.
If he can't find $20,000 in cash lying around, he gets hit with ordinary income tax and a 10% penalty on that missing $20,000. That is devastating.
Yeah.
This is why you always do a direct trustee to trustee transfer. Never let them hand you the check.
It is a massive unforced error. And while we are on the topic of rollovers, there is one final gotcha that ties everything together. We just discussed RMDs. You cannot roll over an RMD.
Wait, really? So if I'm 75 years old and my required distribution for the year is $5,000, I pull it out of my IRA. I don't need the money to live on. I can't just slide that $5,000 to a different IRA or my current 401k.
You cannot. Think about the underlying logic of the rule. By definition, a required minimum distribution is required to be distributed to you. The IRS is demanding that money exit the tax-deferred shelter permanently so it can be taxed.
So if I try to sneak it into another account?
The IRS essentially says, nice try, and treats it as an excess contribution to the new account. And excess contributions are subject to a brutal 6% annual penalty every single year that money stays in the account until you fix the error. Only the portion of a withdrawal that exceeds your RMD amount for the year is eligible to be rolled over.
Wow. The IRS does not play games with their revenue collection. Okay, so we have exhaustively covered the individual side of the equation. But let's be real. Most Americans build the bulk of their wealth where they spend most of their time at work. So let's pivot. Let's look at Section 3, the corporate safety net, formerly known as qualified employer plans.
These are the heavy hitters of wealth accumulation. Qualified plans are employer-sponsored plans that meet very strict, complex requirements under the Internal Revenue Code and ERISA.
And they get a lot of benefits for doing that, right?
In exchange for following these rules specifically, highly complex testing rules designed to ensure the plan doesn't just discriminate in favor of highly compensated executives like Dr. Dave Bill. The employer gets a massive benefit, an immediate tax deduction for their contributions. The money grows tax-deferred for the employees. And crucially for the exam, the employees receive creditor protection under ERISA.
ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. This is huge. If Frank, the founder's company, gets sued into oblivion because his AI toasters caught fire, his employees' 401k accounts are completely safe from the company's creditors.
Yes, completely protected.
That is a massive structural benefit. Now, to understand these employer plans, we first have to draw a hard, bold line between the two major categories, defined benefit versus defined contribution.
This is a fundamental foundational concept for the Series 65. You must know the difference. Let's look at them side by side. A defined benefit plan, what our parents and grandparents just called a traditional pension, promises a specific mathematically calculated monthly payout at retirement. The formula is usually based on a combination of your years of service and your final average salary.
So the deal is, Teacher Tina, work for this school district for 30 years, and we promise you will get $4,000 a month for the rest of your natural life.
Exactly. The benefit is defined. Now, think about the mechanics of making that promise. Because the employer is making a binding promise about the final outcome decades in the future, the employer bears 100% of the investment risk.
So they have to manage all that money.
Yes. The employer has to hire actuaries, they have to pool all the money into a massive trust, and they have to invest it. If the stock market crashes right before Tina retires and the trust loses half its value, it does not matter to Tina. The employer still legally owes her that $4,000 a month. The employer has to dig into their own pockets to make up the shortfall.
Okay, listener, memorize this mnemonic for the exam.
Mm-hmm.
DB equals defined benefit equals the employer cries when the market crashes.
That is accurate. And because these pensions are so critical to retirees' survival, and because companies sometimes go bankrupt, defined benefit plans in the private sector are insured by a federal agency called the PBGC, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation.
Okay, so a safety net for the safety net.
Exactly. If a massive steel company goes bankrupt and can't pay its pensions, the PBGC steps in like an insurance company to pay the retirees, up to certain statutory limits.
Now, compare that to what most of us have today, a defined contribution plan, like a 401k.
The shift from defined benefit to defined contribution is the story of modern American finance. With a defined contribution plan, the employer promises absolutely nothing about your final retirement income.
So what do they promise?
They only promise a specific contribution amount today. They say, Frank, we will match 3% of your salary this year. That money goes into your own individual segregated account. You, the employee, choose the investments from a menu of options.
And if I decide to put all my retirement money into a highly volatile emerging markets tech fund, and it goes to absolute zero right before my retirement party,
the employer owes you absolutely nothing. They wash their hands of it. In a defined contribution plan, the employee bears 100% of the investment risk. You are entirely responsible for your own outcomes.
So, to mirror the mnemonic DC equals defined contribution equals the employee cries when the market crashes. And I assume, since it's my risk, there is no PBGC insurance here.
None whatsoever. If your 401k balance drops by 50% in a bear market, that is simply your new balance. You bear the loss. The PBGC only insures defined benefit plans.
Okay, that distinction is super clear. Risk transfer is the key. Now let's wade into what I call the alphabet soup of defined contribution plans. You see these numbers all over the exam, 401k, 403b, 457b. To a normal person, these just look like random sections of the tax code, which they are. How do we tell them apart functionally?
Let's start with the similarities. For 2026, all three of these plans allow an employee to defer up to $24,500 of their own salary into the account.
Right. The baseline contribution limits are identical across the board. The differences lie entirely in who is legally allowed to use them and a few unique quirks attached to each.
Correct. The 401k is the workhorse. It is the most common plan in America. It is designed for the private sector, profit-driven corporations.
Like Dave's Hospital if it's a private company.
Exactly. Employer matches are very common here as a retention tool. The 401k also typically allows employees to take loans against their own balance and permits hardship withdrawals if the employee is facing a severe, immediate financial emergency like eviction or massive medical bills.
Okay, standard corporate America. If you work for a normal company, you probably have a 401k. Now, let's bring in teacher Tina. Tina doesn't work for a profit-driven corporation. She works for a public school district. What does she get?
Tina gets a 403B, which is historically sometimes referred to as a tax-sheltered annuity, or TSA. These plans are exclusively for public educational institutions, 501c3, tax-exempt nonprofits, and religious organizations.
Any difference in how they invest?
One key historical difference to remember is the investment options. While a modern 401k might offer a brokerage window where you can buy individual stocks, 403B investments are generally restricted by law to mutual funds and annuity contracts.
But Tina has a secret weapon in her 403B, a massive exam gotcha that only applies to her. Walk us through the loyalty bonus.
This is the 15-year service catch-up rule. Because teacher Tina is incredibly loyal and has been with her exact same school district for 15 years, the IRS grants her a special reward. They allow her to contribute an extra $3,000 per year into her 403B, on top of the normal limit, up to a lifetime maximum of $15,000.
Let me clarify. Is this the normal age 50 catch-up, or is this something different?
It is entirely separate. It has nothing to do with her age. It is purely a reward for 15 years of continuous service with a qualified employer. A 40-year-old teacher who started at 25 gets it.
Oh, wow. So she could double up if she was over 50.
She could. And this is the critical exam point. The trap 401k plans do not have this feature. Dr. Dave could work at his private for-profit hospital for 40 years, and he does not get a years of service catch-up. It is utterly unique to the 403B ecosystem.
So, listener, if you are reading a question and it mentions an extra $3,000 catch-up for a 45-year-old, you know immediately they are looking for the 403B answer and a teacher, nurse, or nonprofit worker. Do not pick 401K. Okay, let's move to the last bowl of alphabet soup, the 457B. The 457B is designed for state and local government employees. Think police officers, firefighters, and municipal city managers. And it possesses what I consider the ultimate exam gotcha, the single most unique, powerful rule among all defined contribution retirement plans. Let me jump in here. When I was reviewing the notes for this, I actually didn't believe what I was reading. I thought it was a typo. I had to go look up the IRS code myself. The notes say a 457B plan has no 10% early withdrawal penalty at all.
It's true.
Are you seriously telling me that if a city manager or a cop quits their job at age 40, they can just drain their entire 457B retirement account to buy a pontoon boat without paying the 10% IRS early withdrawal penalty?
That is exactly what I am telling you. It is a remarkable feature. If you separate from service, meaning you quit, retire, or are fired, you can withdraw funds from a governmental 457D plan at absolutely any age, and there is zero 10% penalty.
That is insane.
Now, to be clear, you still have to pay ordinary income tax on the withdrawal because it is pre-tax money, but the 10% penalty simply does not exist for these plans.
That is wild. Let's compare that. If Frank, the founder, quits his corporate job at age 40 and drains his 401k, he gets destroyed by the 10% penalty. If Tina drains her 403b early, penalty. But the firefighter with the 457b walks away totally penalty free. Why does the government allow that?
It primarily stems from the nature of the jobs. Many municipal jobs, particularly first responders like police and fire, have very early mandatory or standing retirement ages, often in their late 490s or early 50s. The tax code accommodates the fact that they will likely need to draw on their retirement savings long before age 59 and a half.
That makes a lot of sense conceptually, but it is a massively testable distinction. What else is weird about the 457B?
It also has a unique special 3-year catch-up provision. In the 3 years prior to their designated normal retirement age, a 457B participant can defer up to double the annual limit. So in 2026, instead of the standard $24,500, they could potentially defer up to $49,000 in a single year to rapidly catch up on savings.
Double the limit. Government benefits really do have their perks. Okay, before we leave employer plans entirely, let's flag one recent major rule change regarding Roth accounts that live inside these employer plans.
Yes, this is a very testable update. For a long time, there was an incredibly annoying discrepancy in the law. If you had a personal Roth IRA, as we discussed, you did not have to take RMDs. You could leave it forever.
VIP club.
Right. But if you had a Roth 401k or a Roth 403b through your employer, the IRS forced you to take required minimum distributions at age 73, exactly like a pre-tax account. And because the withdrawals were Roth, they were totally tax-free anyway. It was a pointless administrative burden that just forced money out of the tax shelter.
It made zero logical sense. They finally fixed it, right?
It did. Congress passed legislation that completely eliminated RMDs for Roth accounts within employer plans during the original owner's lifetime. A Roth 401k is now treated exactly identically to a Roth IRA when it comes to RMDs. You can leave the money in the employer plan forever.
That is an excellent recent update to know for the exam. Okay, we've covered the giants. Let's look at the little guys. What happens when you don't have an HR department setting all of this up for you? We're entering Frank the Founder's playground. Small business shenanigans.
Frank's territory.
If you are self-employed or you run a tiny startup with 3 employees in a garage, you aren't going to pay the massive administrative fees to set up a full-blown 401k infrastructure. You are looking at the SEP, the simple, or the solo 401k. Let's start with a direct comparison because they sound similar. The SEP IRA versus the simple IRA.
Let's analyze the SEP IRA first, the simplified employee pension. The most critical defining feature of a SEP, the thing you must memorize, is that it is funded by employer contributions only. Employees are not allowed to defer any of their own salary into a SEP.
So Frank opens a SEP for his toaster startup. He cannot send out an email to his 3 employees saying, hey team, we have a retirement plan now. Fill out this form to withhold 5% of your paycheck.
Correct. The employees just sit back and watch. The funding is entirely on Frank. Frank, as the employer, can contribute up to 25% of an employee's compensation, all the way up to a massive maximum limit of $72,000 for 2026.
Wow, up to $72,000. That is huge. But why would Frank, a guy who hates spending money, choose a SEP if he has to fund the whole thing out of his own pocket?
Because it is incredibly easy and highly flexible. A full 401k requires filing a complex annual Form 5500 with the Department of Labor. It requires non-discrimination testing. A SEP requires none of that. Frank just keeps a simple form, 5305 SEP, on file in a desk drawer.
Nice and easy.
And even better, for a chaotic business owner who never knows his cash flow, Frank does not have to fund the SEP by December 31st. He can establish and fund the SEP all the way up to his business tax filing deadline, including extensions.
Oh, that's a huge perk. So Frank gets to next April or even next October on extension, his accountant tells him he owes a massive tax bill, and Frank can just retroactively dump tens of thousands of dollars into the SEP for the prior year to lower his taxes at the last possible second.
Exactly. It is the ultimate procrastinator's tax shelter. But what if Frank does want his employees to take some responsibility and contribute their own money?
Right, if he doesn't want to pay for all of it.
Then the SEP is useless to him. He needs to pivot to a simple IRA, Savings Incentive Match Plan for Employees. This is designed for small employers with 100 or fewer employees. Under a simple, employees can elect to defer their own salary. They can put in up to $17,000 in 2026, or $18,100 if the employer opts into an enhanced limit.
But there's a catch for Frank, right? He can't just set it up and walk away. If he offers a simple, he has to put his own skin in the game.
Yes. The trade-off for the simplicity of the plan is that the employer contribution is mandatory. Frank must choose one of two options every single year. He either provides a dollar-for-dollar match up to 3% of the employee's compensation, or he makes a flat 2% non-elective contribution to every single eligible employee, regardless of whether that employee puts in a single dime of their own money.
Okay, listener, let's recap that directly.
Yeah.
SEP equals employer money only, highly flexible up to 25%. Simple equals employees can contribute, but the employer must provide a 3% match or a 2% flat gift.
Exactly. But now we have to talk about the trap. The simple trap.
Yes. I promised the listeners a 25% penalty at the top of the show, and it's time to deliver.
We talked extensively earlier about the standard 10% early withdrawal penalty if you touch retirement money before age 59 and a half. The simple IRA has a brutal, unique rule designed to trap the unwary. If you withdraw money from a simple IRA within the first 2 years of your participation in the plan, the early withdrawal penalty is not 10%. It jumps to 25%.
25%?
Yeah.
Just as a pure penalty on top of your normal income tax bracket. Why on earth is it so high?
It is entirely punitive. It is designed by Congress to aggressively discourage low-income or entry-level employees from treating their brand-new retirement account as a short-term emergency savings account. They want that money locked in. After you have been in the plan for exactly 2 years, the penalty drops back down to the standard 10%. But in those first 24 months, touching that money is a 25% wealth-destroying event.
Listener, if I see a question on the Series 65 asking about a 25% early withdrawal penalty, my brain is going to immediately scream, simple IRA first 2 years. That is such a specific, weird number, it is practically guaranteed to be a distractor or a correct answer. Okay, what if Frank gets tired of managing people, fires all his employees, and it's just him working solo out of the garage?
Then he unlocks what is arguably the best retirement vehicle in existence, the solo 401k, also known as an individual 401k. This is legally restricted to self-included individuals with zero employees other than a spouse.
So just Frank and maybe his wife.
Right. A solo 401k is incredibly powerful because Frank gets to wear two hats simultaneously. He acts as the employee, allowing him to defer $24,500 of his own income. And he acts as the employer, allowing him to contribute up to 25% of his net self-employment income, up to a combined massive total of $72,000.
It's like double dipping the tax code. It is the ultimate tool for a solo consultant. But I want to focus on a bizarre legislative quirk with the catch-up contributions for these employer plans. Listeners, another direct question for you. Pay very close attention to the math I am about to lay out.
This one makes no sense, so listen closely.
Let's say you are 55 years old. The IRS gives you an $8,000 standard catch-up contribution. Now you turn 60. You hit a newly created super catch-up window, and your allowable catch-up jumps from $8,000 to $11,250. You feel great. You ride that higher limit at age 60, age 61, age 62, and age 63. Okay, here's the question. You just had your 64th birthday. Does your catch-up limit go up, or does it stay the same?
This is one of the most illogical rules written into the recent tax law updates. When you turn 64, your catch-up contribution limit actually drops back down to $8,000.
Wait, think about human aging. I get older, I'm 1 year closer to actual retirement, I have less time to save, and the IRS decides to lower my catch-up limit.
Yes. The super catch-up of $11,250 is explicitly and exclusively legislated for ages 60, 61, 62, and 63. Once you hit 64, that specific super catch-up window slams shut, and you revert back to the standard age 50 catch-up amount.
Why did Congress do that? It makes zero intuitive sense.
It was largely a product of legislative compromise and budget scoring. They wanted to encourage savings in that specific pre-retirement window, but extending it indefinitely costs too much in projected tax revenue. Because it makes so little intuitive sense, it is exactly the kind of detail the exam will test. They want to see if you memorize the specific illogical age window.
That is baffling. Happy 64th birthday. You are closer to retirement, so you are legally allowed to save less money this year. Got it. 60 to 63 is the magic window. Is there any other catch-up gotcha we need to know?
Yes, specifically for high earners like Dr. Dave. If you made over $150,000 in FICA wages from your employer in the prior year, the IRS says you are no longer allowed to make your catch-up contributions on a pre-tax basis. High earners are forced by law to make all catch-up contributions as Roth after-tax contributions.
Ah, I see what they're doing. They forced Dr. Dave to pay taxes right now, today, on that extra catch-up money.
Yeah.
The IRS wants their revenue today from the high earners.
Exactly. It accelerates tax revenue for the Treasury, which brings us perfectly to our final section of the day. We have to talk about what happens when Dr. Dave hits all these limits and wants more. Let's talk about the velvet rope and golden handcuffs.
We have spent this entire deep dive talking about qualified plans, the rules, the limits, the non-discrimination testing. But Dr. Dave makes $500,000 a year. He hits his $24,500 401k limit in February. His hospital conglomerate desperately wants to keep him happy so he doesn't leave for a competitor. They want to give him an extra $500,000 in deferred compensation.
Which is very common for executives.
Right. But under ERISA rules, if they offer a massive qualified benefit to Dave, they have to offer proportional benefits to the janitorial staff, the cafeteria workers, and the nurses, which obviously the hospital is not going to do. How do they give Dave a mountain of deferred money without giving it to everyone else?
They step completely outside the qualified system, and they create a non-qualified retirement plan.
The velvet rope.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Non-qualified plans do not seek IRS approval. They do not have to meet ERISA non-discrimination rules. The employer has absolute total flexibility. The board of directors can look at the company directory, point to Dr. Dave and three other top surgeons, and say, "We are setting up a special deferred compensation plan strictly for you four. No one else in the hospital gets a single dime."
Okay, if it's that easy, what is the core trade-off? Why doesn't every company just do this for everything and ignore ERISA entirely?
Because the IRS demands a heavy price for skipping their rules. With a qualified 401k, the employer gets to deduct their contributions immediately from their corporate taxes. With a non-qualified plan, the employer gets zero tax deduction today. They only get to deduct the expense years or decades later when the money is actually distributed and paid out to Dr. Dave as taxable income.
So the company takes a tax hit now by deferring their deduction. But what is the trade-off for Dave? He's getting the money eventually, right?
Dave loses something much, much more valuable than a tax deduction. Dave loses ERISA creditor protection.
Oh, that's huge.
It is. When you put money into a 401k, that money is held in a legally separate trust. It is walled off from the company. If the hospital goes bankrupt, the hospital's creditors cannot touch your 401k. But non-qualified plans are entirely different. By law, the assets in a non-qualified plan remain the general assets of the employer.
I want to use a really vivid analogy here. Being in a non-qualified plan is like asking your boss to hold your entire life savings inside his personal mattress at his house. If a burglar breaks into his house, your money is gone.
That is a very dramatic but legally accurate analogy. Let's look at a SERP, a supplemental executive retirement plan. Supplemental is the key word. It
Yeah.
goes on top of Dave's 401k. The hospital promises Dave a massive payout at retirement. But a SERPOP has no PBGC insurance. It's often just an unfunded promise on a ledger. Dave is legally classified as an unsecured general creditor of the hospital.
Okay, but Dr. Dave isn't an idiot. Surely the hospital's high-priced lawyers come up with something that sounds a lot safer than a mattress. What's the exam got you here?
The exam will try to trick you by introducing a vehicle called a rabbi trust.
A rabbi trust. That sounds incredibly safe. It sounds whole.
It does sound safe. It actually gets its name from a very specific IRS private letter ruling in the early 1980s involving a synagogue setting up deferred compensation for their rabbi. An employer might tell Dr. Dave, "Don't worry, Dave, we aren't just making an empty promise on a piece of paper. We are actually setting aside your deferred compensation into a rabbi trust right now."
So Dave feels safe. The money is literally in a trust.
Dave is wrong to feel safe. This is the ultimate trap of non-qualified plans. The defining legal characteristic of a rabbi trust, the reason the IRS allows it to exist without taxing Dave immediately on constructive receipt of the money, is that the assets inside the trust must remain entirely subject to the claims of the employer's general creditors in the event of insolvency or bankruptcy.
Wait, let me process that.
Yeah.
So if the hospital goes bankrupt, the bankruptcy judge can literally crack open this so-called trust and give Dave's millions to the people the hospital owes money to.
Yes. Dave is standing in the exact same legal line as the vendors who sold the hospital printer paper and bandages. If the hospital goes under, Dave could lose every single dime of his deferred compensation. The trust protects him from the hospital's management changing their mind and taking the money back, but it offers zero protection from bankruptcy.
That is terrifying.
It is terrifying by design. This brings us back to the concept of golden handcuffs. If Dr. Dave has $5 million tied up in a SERP and a rabbi trust, he is highly, highly incentivized to make sure the hospital remains profitable and solvent. If he makes reckless decisions, or if the executives steer the company into bankruptcy, his own massive retirement payout gets wiped out. He is handcuffed to the financial health of the corporation.
Wow. The golden handcuffs. So for the exam listener, if you see the words non-qualified plan or rabbi trust, the immediate automatic association in your brain must be no creditor protection, subject to general creditors in bankruptcy. That is the fundamental defining risk of the velvet rope.
Precisely. The ultimate flexibility to discriminate comes at the ultimate cost of security.
All right. We have covered a truly massive amount of ground today. From the sticky floors of the traditional IRA dive bar to the velvet ropes of the Roth VIP club, through the anxiety-inducing 60-day rollover hostage situations, down to Frank's brutal 25% simple penalty, and ending with Dave's golden handcuffs. Let's bring the energy up for the final stretch. We are going to lock this in for exam day. We're going to do a rapid-fire recap of the top five heavily testable takeaways from this entire deep dive.
Number one, know your phase-outs intimately. A Roth IRA has a contribution phase-out. If you make too much money, the bouncer won't let you put money in. A traditional IRA has a deduction phase out. Anyone can put money in, but high earners with a workplace plan will not get the tax deduction.
Number two, the $10,000 first-time homebuyer exception and the higher education exception to the 10% early withdrawal penalty apply to IRAs only. They do absolutely not apply to 401ks or other employer plans. Do not fall for Frank's 401k house trap.
Number three, the 457b plan for government workers is incredibly unique because it has NO, 10% early withdrawal penalty upon separation from service, regardless of how young you are when you quit.
Number four, the simple IRA has a brutal punitive penalty. If you withdraw money in the first 2 years of participating, the penalty jumps from 10% to 25%.
And number five, non-qualified plans and rabbi trusts provide absolutely no protection from employer bankruptcy. The executive is legally nothing more than an unsecured general creditor.
Bam, there it is. Your cheat code to the retirement plan section of the Series 65. Now, before we sign off, I want to hand it over to the expert for one final thought to leave you chewing on as you hit the books.
We just spent an hour talking about how to navigate these complex IRS rules, but I want you to step back and think about the psychological side of the system. If the government creates an incredibly complex, labyrinthine rule, like giving you exactly a 60-day window to replace a 20% tax withholding on an indirect rollover using your own personal cash, or imposing a sudden 25% penalty for touching a simple IRA early, or creating a super catch-up that inexplicably drops when you turn 64.
Right, none of it makes sense.
Exactly. Are they really doing it just to help you save? Or, on some level, are they banking on human error to collect the penalty revenue? When you sit down at that testing center, don't just ask yourself, what is the rule? Ask yourself, how is the IRS trying to trap the taxpayer here? Because if you can spot the trap in the real world, you will spot the correct answer on the screen.
That is exactly the mindset you need. Spot the trap. You got this. Keep studying. Use these characters in your head. Visualize Frank messing up his rollover and go crush the Series 65. We'll see you on the next deep dive.